Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming this morning by Bonnie Harper, who's serving as our worship associate, our music director, Hal Walker, and our director of religious education, Karen Lapidus. I'm glad to introduce a special guest with us this morning, David Petras, a former member of this congregation from the early 1990s. He moved to Columbus and is now a member of North Unitarian Universalist. He's also a member of the Ohio Meadville District Board of Trustees and one of the founders of the Phoenix Witness Project, which we'll be hearing more about later today. So please give David a warm welcome. And now we have a special announcement from the geezers.
Good morning. Our esteemed finance committee has asked us to add a little musical ingredient to the finance campaign for you.
And since we can't do that,
in other words, it's a shameless commercial. A long, long time ago, I can still remember how the canvas used to make me cry. And perhaps we would have a chance through fundraising and happenstance, and perhaps just somehow we'd get by. But every year I would shiver when that line item budget was delivered. Many words were spoken, the toilets all were broken. But this year is a different try, and we can all breathe a deep sigh and even make a joyful cry, 'cause our budget, it is a pie. Started singing my Unitarian pie. Bring your vision to our kitchen so our mission survives. We can all live purposeful and meaningful lives, singing this'll be the day that we thrive. This'll be the day that we thrive. Hey, let's not leave this all to chance. And what do you bring to the dance? Let's make sure we don't leave out a thing. Add some sugar, say a few words, add 4 and 20 fat black birds, and now we've got a pie that can really sing. Well, the mathematicians have declared, they say they've proved that pi are squared. But one thing we have found, we know that pi are round. We're a growing congregation, let's all pitch in on this creation, and we shall feast in elation the day our pie is made. And we were singing, my Unitarian pie. Bring your vision to our kitchen so our mission survives. We can all live purposeful and meaningful lives, singing this'll be the day that we thrive. This'll be the day that we thrive. Well, now we no longer sing the blues, 'cause we can pay our district dues. And we can all take comfort for today. And I went down to Pheasant Hall and thought of those old bathroom stalls, and I'm reminded that we've come a long, long way. And in the classrooms the children scream, together we can live our dream. Not a word is spoken, the toilets are not broken. Summer's heat will easily bear when we install the central air. Then a la mode will be our fare, the day our pie is made. And we were singing, my Unitarian pie. Bring your vision to our kitchen so our mission survives. So we can all live purposeful and meaningful lives. Singing, this'll be the day that we thrive. This'll be the day that we thrive. And everybody was singing, my Unitarian pie. Bring your vision to our kitchen so our mission survives. So we can all live purposeful and meaningful lives. Singing, this'll be the day that we thrive.
May our chalice be the light of justice. May our hearts be the burning within this chalice, bright as love in the distance. Only the work of justice is this light at the end of the tunnel. The road is long and the traveling slow, but we don't have to walk this road all alone. But Lord, I pray that every woman and man could be walking with a brother, holding hand in hand. Or maybe walking with a sister, holding hand in hand. May our chalice be the light of justice. May our hearts be the burning within this chalice, bright as love in the distance. Only the work of justice is this light at the end of the tunnel. We are one in the working love, and we walk on till the work's done, and we make change as the road moves on, and the people on their way sing a joyful song. Everybody on your way sing a joyful song. May our chalice be the light of justice. May our hearts be the burning within this chalice, bright as love in the distance. Only the work of justice is this light at the end of the tunnel. May our chalice be the light of justice. May our chalice be the light of goodness. May our chalice be the light at the end of the tunnel.
Our wisdom words come from the book Black Elk Speaks by John Neihardt, which was originally published in 1932. The book is Neihardt's recreation in English of the oral history that Black Elk, a medicine man of the Oglala Sioux Indians, recounted for him in the Sioux language in 1931. Hear me, four quarters of the world, a relative I am. Give me the strength to walk the soft earth. A relative to all that is. Give me the eyes to see and the strength to understand that I may be like you. Great Spirit, my grandfather, all over the earth, the faces of living things are all alike. With tenderness have these come up out of the ground. Look at the faces of these children without number, with children in their arms, that they may face the wind and walk the good road unto the day of quiet. And I invite you to join me now in the spirit of prayer, a collective prayer. We've heard two languages today, and I'd like to share with you a third that we'll incorporate into our prayer, American Sign Language. The word is thank you. Thank you. And please. Thank you. And please. And so as we pray this prayer together, I invite you to say thank you and please in the praying of the prayer. Once again, the sun has risen and the earth shifted on its axis, bringing us to the first days of spring. Thank you for the sun and the rain. Thank you for the warmth and the light. Thank you for the bud and the flower. Thank you for the color, for the sound of birdsong, frog song, for the sound of life awakening. Thank you for these bodies. Thank you for these lives. Thank you for these many gifts we have been given. Our hearts overflow with gratitude. Gratitude. Flowing from it, respect. Please, help us to live our lives with respect, flowing from gratitude for all these gifts we have been given. Please help us to treat our own bodies with respect. Please help us to treat with respect all those others whom we encounter in a day. Please help us to treat the earth with respect, this home we all share. Respect flowing from gratitude. Today we'll make hundreds of little choices. Please help us to make choices that honor ourselves, one another, and this glorious life. May it be so, and amen.
My Tribe by Alberto Blanco, translated by James Nolan. Earth is the same, sky another. Sky is the same, earth another. From lake to lake, forest to forest, which tribe is mine? I ask myself, where's my place? Perhaps I belong to the tribe of those who have none, or the black sheep tribe, or a tribe whose ancestors come from the future, a tribe on the horizon. But if I have to belong to some tribe, I tell myself, make it a large tribe, make it a strong tribe, one in which nobody is left out, in which everybody, for once and for all, has a God-given place. I'm not talking about a human tribe. I'm not talking about a planetary tribe. I'm not even talking about a universal one. I'm talking about a tribe you can't talk about, a tribe that's always been, but whose existence must yet be proven. A tribe that's always been, but whose existence we can prove right now.
Good morning. My name is David Petrus, and I am a member of the Ohio Meadville District Board of Trustees. And I want to thank you for giving me time today to weave together a number of threads on immigration, economic justice, and our Ohio Meadville District's ambitions that have come together as the Phoenix Witness Project. Now, let me state to begin without hesitation that I am not an immigrant. However, given that one's mere assertion is apparently no longer sufficient, I have brought a copy of my birth certificate to show that I am not an immigrant. Now, in addition, my father was not an immigrant. My grandfather was not an immigrant. But my great-grandfather, now he was an immigrant. Martin Petrus left Russian-occupied Poland in 1888. He was 38 years old, bringing his wife and three children soon thereafter. But it's why he left that's really relevant to my discussion today. Now, my great-grandfather was quite enterprising, and he saw that cigarettes were cheap, but vodka expensive in Imperial Germany, while vodka was cheap, but cigarettes expensive in Tsarist Russia. So he engaged in some cross-border shipping, but without troubling the authorities about those bothersome tariffs and taxes. So as a result of his enterprise, he was wanted by both the Kaiser's and the Tsar's police, making America a compelling choice. So what kind of immigrant was my great-grandfather if we applied today's laws to 1888? Well, he was, in the social Darwinism of the time, from a less advanced race, being Slavic. He was beholden to a foreign prince the Pope, and he was a criminal wanted by two sovereign states. Needless to say, I'm very fortunate that my grandfather emigrated in 1888 and not 2012, as he would fare very poorly under today's laws. Now, I'm confident most of us can look to our own history and find ancestors similar to my great-grandfather, people seeking a new or better life in America. But as a nation, we have been trying for 130 years to close tighter and tighter our borders, to keep out the other, the different, the threatening. Now, immigration is both a new and old concept. If we start with the current anthropological and archaeological consensus, since we are not in East Central Africa, which appears to be the historic birthplace of Homo sapiens, we are all immigrants as our species moved out of Africa over the last 50 to 60,000 years. And as a species, over almost all of that entire time, we lived together in small hunter-gatherer bands of 50 to 150 people. And these bands are the centrality of your existence. Either someone was a member of the band or they were a stranger. Now, Jared Diamond, who is famous for two recent books, Guns, Germs, and Steel, and Collapse, actually spent most of his career studying hunter-gatherer bands in Highland, New Guinea. And he describes when two strangers meet, they begin to discuss who they are related to in an effort to find a family connection, to change that stranger from being an enemy to someone who is part of the family, therefore not a stranger and not a threat. So this distrust of outsiders is something that's inherent in our species. And defining who is and who is not part of the band is really the bulk of immigration history. So in addition to this anthropological, species-wide fear of outsiders, we also have to consider our English cultural history. Many of our archetypes and ideals, the preference of the pastoral over the corrupt city, the small town ideal, neighborliness, community, all of these arise from this small and very homogeneous island that had almost no immigration until the 20th century. So this parochialism from England you can see transplanted into New England, and I think this is captured hopefully in this hopefully apocryphal story. Now, Matthew Smith moves with his family from upstate New York to a small town in Vermont when he's 5 years old. He goes to the local school, works on his parents' dairy farm, eventually inheriting the farm. He marries a local girl and has seven children. He's active in the local Unitarian Church and even serves as mayor of the town in his retirement. Finally, Matthew Smith dies at 92 years old, and on his tombstone in the church cemetery, they write, "Matthew Smith, he was almost one of us." Now, like all humor, there must be a grain of truth in this. And these attitudes, this distrust of the outsider, it's a cultural legacy. And so when we talk about immigration and how we as a society choose to tackle it, we have to look at it where we stand in this socio-cultural landscape. Now, as I was preparing with Reverend Carvel Zeemer, she mentioned to me that you are very familiar or have been made familiar with the history of the laws of the U.S. government and its attempts to address immigration, starting with the Naturalization Act of 1790, which allowed any free white person of good moral character who's resided in the U.S. for 2 years to become a citizen, through the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, and finally the closing of the Golden Door of American Immigration with the Quota Act of 1921. Now, all of these and almost all of our immigration laws, with the exception of the Hart-Celler Act of 1965, and including items as recent as the USA Patriot Act, it's very easy to see how race has played an unacknowledged but primary role in U.S. immigration policy. So one result of this history, both cultural and American law, is you can see how Arizona has come to see itself as being on the front lines of the immigration battle. And this is really the mindset, this war mindset, that led it to pass Senate Bill 1070 in 2010. Now, Senate Bill 1070 made a lot of changes and imposed a lot of new requirements on police. But really, my personal favorite, and one that's exemplary of the tone of the law, is that it requires police in any legal stop, a traffic stop, if there's a reasonable suspicion that the person is an illegal alien, police are required to hold that suspect indefinitely until that person can prove that he or she is in the country legally. So, of course, this will mean everywhere I go in Arizona, I will have to carry my birth certificate, my papers, to show that I'm not an illegal immigrant, correct? Of course not. No police officer will suspect me of being an illegal immigrant. I'm white, I have almost naturally blonde hair, and I speak Midwestern accented English. This and other provisions of the law clearly target Hispanic citizens and everyone else who can be seen as the other. So, in response to Senate Bill 1070, organizations imposed economic boycotts on Arizona and pulled out of planned conventions. This, in fact, was the reaction of the Unitarian Universalist Association board to move our Phoenix 2012 General Assembly, but to their everlasting credit, General Assembly in 2010, in consultation with the Arizona UU congregations, said no. Instead of a boycott, the 2010 General Assembly decided that we, as a movement, will go and bear witness. We will go and do justice. We will reach out into the immigrant community in Phoenix, and we will live our values, and we will take a stand on the side of love. So instead of a General Assembly in Phoenix, 2012, we will have a Justice Assembly.
A justice assembly. We'll be going to Phoenix for a justice assembly that will be focusing on the national problems of racial and immigration injustice, knowing that Arizona, while the first, is tragically no longer the only state in our country to have enacted ill-informed anti-immigrant laws. Several states have followed suit, the most recent being Mississippi, whose House passed legislation quite similar to SB 1070 this past week. The Senate is expected to pass it soon, and the governor has already indicated that he'll sign the measure. I mentioned Mississippi because there was an incident there this week that perfectly exemplifies the social consequences of the thinking behind such misguided laws. This incident happened at an NCAA basketball game on Thursday, played between Kansas State and Southern Mississippi. The Southern Miss school band started a full-throttled "Where's Your Green Card" chant aimed at Kansas State guard Angel Rodriguez. Now, the chant was plainly racist, but it was also profoundly ignorant because Rodriguez is from Puerto Rico. He is a United States citizen. The president of Southern Miss issued a statement just 2 hours after the game, distancing the school from the actions of a few bad apples. But if we dig a little deeper, we can see that the problem is not with the apples. The problem is with the soil that the apple trees have grown in, which we've all grown in, which is in desperate need of nutritive amendments. This story goes all the way back to the 15th century in Europe. Now, we all know the story of European colonization and exploration of the New World. But many of us don't know how that colonization was justified by both church and state. One of the first justifications was issued by Pope Alexander VI in a 1493 papal bull, which proclaimed that heathen nations of other quarters of the globe were lawful spoil and prey of their civilized conquerors. A series of papal bulls and monarchical decrees followed, reaffirming this idea, including a decree issued by King Henry VII in 1496, in which he gave a patent to John Cabot and Sons to seek out and discover all islands, regions, and provinces whatsoever that may belong to heathens or infidels, to subdue and occupy and possess these territories. Taken together, this series of bulls and decrees has come to be known as the Doctrine of Discovery or the Doctrine of Christian Discovery. How many of you have heard of that before? A couple people? I hadn't heard of it either until this past year, but it turns out that we really need to know about this because this has a lot to do with how the United States operates today. You see, that European principle of law was codified into the United States law of our young nation not very long after its founding. In the early 1800s, the United States Supreme Court heard a case, Johnson versus Emmentosh, which was a case between land speculators in Illinois, arguing over who had first rights to Indian land. Chief Justice John Marshall wrote the majority opinion in favor of the speculators, arguing that Christian people who had discovered the lands of heathens had assumed the ultimate right of dominion to be in themselves, and that as a result, the Indians had no sovereignty, but only a right of occupancy for their lands. As authority, Chief Justice cited the Doctrine of Discovery, thereby codifying it into United States law. The Doctrine of Discovery has been used again and again as legal precedent by United States judges when ruling in favor of the United States government in legal contests with Native American Indians, including as recently as the Oneida Nation versus the State of New York in 2005. The Doctrine of Discovery is but one powerful example of the ways in which European immigrants to this nation, of whom most of us are descendants, have claimed privilege for ourselves at the terrible expense of the indigenous people of this land. Tupac Enrique Acosta is one of the leaders of Tonatiuh Nahuacali, a cultural embassy of the indigenous people. I met him when I went to protest in Phoenix against SB 1070 almost 2 years ago. Speaking about the law, Tupac has argued that its purpose was to consolidate the perceptions of some white Americans around the idea of an America that is white and a continent that belongs to them. However, as he has explained many times, indigenous people have not crossed our borders. Our borders have crossed them, their bodies, their histories, their people, their lands. For centuries, indigenous people have been migrating freely between what is now the United States and Mexico. Among many other harmful consequences, SB 1070 impedes the free movement of indigenous people. Tonatiuh is one of several partner organizations we're working with in preparation for our Justice Assembly. Our partners have called upon Unitarian Universalists to learn about the Doctrine of Discovery. They've been calling for religious organizations to do this for many years, and the only to respond thus far is the Episcopal Church of America, which repudiated it in 2009. We'll be taking up this issue at our Justice Assembly, and we can be the second major religious denomination to join with indigenous people in repudiation of the Doctrine of Discovery and in support of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. In June, we'll have the opportunity to take a stand for justice. This is an important step we can take to be in right relationship with indigenous people of this land. I hope that you'll consider traveling with me and with David to Phoenix in June so that we can take up this holy work. And if you can't come to Phoenix, I hope you'll consider taking the adult religious exploration class that Matt Geckler will be leading this spring, exploring these issues in greater depth. We have been called. How will we answer the call?
So Justice Assembly is one of the threads. And another is the Fifth Principle Task Force report, which was issued in December of 2009. Now, our fifth principle, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and society at large, is part of who we are and what we covenant to profess and live as part of our faith. Within the bylaws of the UUA, it states clearly that authority for the Board of Trustees derives from and rests with the General Assembly. Just as I'm sure your bylaws state that it is the congregation which is sovereign, and your board's powers are derived and granted by the congregation. However, imagine if that board power was based on who attended your congregation's annual meeting. And that annual meeting was held mostly during the work week at a Virgin Islands luxury resort. Now, few of us could attend. And unless seriously blinkered, no one would call that democratic. But this is evocative of the economic discrimination and segregation that the cost of attending General Assembly imposes. To wit, unless you have $2,000 to $3,000 and a week of time to spare, General Assembly is probably not a possibility for you, which in turn leads to General Assemblies that are substantially undemocratic, something that is contrary to one of our stated core goals. The report of the Fifth Principal Task Force states simply, General Assembly as a democratic governance model is dramatically broken. One of the recommendations of the task force was that the EUA consider going to General Assemblies every 2 years and using that savings to defer costs so a broader range of people can attend and participate regardless of economic circumstances. But this is a future goal, and it will not be in place for Justice Assembly. Can we wait? Can we let Justice Assembly be like every other General Assembly, but with a different name? Or can we make a change? Now, my answer and the answer of the Ohio Meadville District Board is that we cannot wait, and that we must do this now. And this commitment has given rise to the Phoenix Witness Project. Now, with the Phoenix Witness Projects, we have been going to congregations throughout the district with a simple request. We're asking for a contribution that we are going to use to make grants and scholarships to help people get to Phoenix this June. In particular, since Justice Assembly should be such a pivotal moment in the history of our faith, we must ensure that our youths and young adults can freely participate and live out the values we preach from this and every pulpit in this district every week. So we will go to Phoenix, and we will stand as we have always stood as a movement for the better angels of our nature, and leaving behind the old verities which divide person from person. Our task in Phoenix will be the one we take up every day as you use, to bear witness, to speak love to hate, to speak justice to intolerance, to live our faith, to stand on the side of love. But in the end, why we contribute, why we attend Justice Assembly, is the same reason we do any justice work. And that is to show that love, that is the doctrine of this church, does not and cannot stop at our front door. Thank you.
The ushers, please come forward. Once each month, we take a special collection for an organization whose work we believe in. This morning, our special collection will go to support scholarships for the Phoenix Witness Project. Now, in addition to taking a special collection to support the scholarship fund, I am issuing an invitation to you, if you have any interest in attending Justice Assembly, to not let money stop you. Because so far, thanks to David's good work, the Phoenix Witness Project has collected $15,000, and they will be disseminating it in early August. The application deadline, April, the application deadline is March 31st. I can tell you more about how to apply if you're interested. There's a little bit about Justice Assembly on the handout in your order of service, and if you're very interested, some pamphlets by the door. In addition to the support offered by the Phoenix Witness Project for scholarships, the UA has also allocated ample scholarships so that money will not be an obstacle for anybody who wants to participate this year. If you are our guest this morning, we have a candle for you as a gift of our welcome. We're glad that you're with us. The offering will now be gratefully received.
Thank you.
We have gathered in witness to the proposition that beneath all of our diversity, there lies a unity which binds us one to the other, to the earth, and to the stars. We've gathered in witness. Let us take our witness out into the world. Go in peace.